Hello and welcome to the podcast edition of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, reviews, previews, and interviews with authors and artists about baseball books, music, film, pretty much anything you can fit on a bookshelf. And that's the slogan, if it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. Fantasy sports is a multi-billion dollar business. With so much at stake, there have to be rules, otherwise there's chaos. From time to time, I try and get with the program. I started reading Larry Schechter's Winning Fantasy Baseball, Secret Strategies of a Nine-Time National Champion, which I highly recommend. But after a while, the numbers just started making me dizzy. Prop me up in front of the TV, give me a cold beverage, and I'm good to go. But like I said, I keep trying. So I called on my friend Mark Adelman. He's an associate professor of law at the Zicklin School of Business at Baruch College in New York. He specializes in sports law, antitrust, intellectual property, and gaming law, and his articles on the subject have appeared in numerous publications, including Forbes. Mark is also the host of the Sports Judge blog, where he and a group of like-minded colleagues hold court on areas of contention, which, let's face it, probably happens when money is at stake. And for a small fee, they provide fantasy sports dispute resolutions by law professors, retired judges, and other legal experts. Mark did his best to educate me recently. We'll see if it sticks. Mark Adelman, thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure, Ron.
So tell me, how big an industry money-wise are we talking here when we talk about fantasy sports?
There have been various estimates ranging between $2 and $5 billion.
Now that's billion with a B.
That's billion with a B. Uh-huh. Now, my estimate of the industry includes everything related from fantasy, including private prize pools. And when you include the private prize pools involved, many people believe we're approaching the $5 billion with a B dollar level.
Now, when you say it's all-inclusive, does that include magazines and publications and various other things that people use to make these judgments and make their decisions?
That's correct. From the numbers, the way I've seen them, if you're talking only about online hosting sites, such as ESPN, Yahoo, and CBS Sports, IBIS estimated that at $1 billion. But if you extend the market to anything related to fantasy sports, whether it be hard copy, digital, or the mere exchange of money for prize winners, that number is believed to approach a lot closer to $5 billion.
Now, do you have further breakdowns by sport, by particular sport?
I do not within the billion-dollar range. In terms of the sports, football is currently listed as a significant number one, followed by baseball at number two. And even though the daily games are beginning to change this, for the last several years, and this surprises people, Fantasy NASCAR is actually listed at third in terms of participation, with basketball fourth, and hockey at best fifth, if not even below that.
No, we're talking just about the United States here. We're not talking about globally.
That's correct. We're talking about the United States. Now, fantasy sports, however, is in much more of an infancy stage overseas. And one of the rationales for that is if you just look at England, for example, England has legal sports gambling run by public companies on the winners of individual games. The William Hill Company is publicly traded on the British Exchange, and they have contests about picking winners of individual games. Because sports books are legal in countries such as England, the development of fantasy sports has gone off to a much slower start.
Now, I want to concentrate on baseball a little bit here because that's what I'm about. Do you think the members of the original Rotisserie League had any idea what they were doing, what it would turn into when they created this, 20, 30 years ago?
I think what you're considering to be the original Rotisserie League would be the one that would be drafted in the Rotisserie restaurant in Manhattan.
Right.
That included Dan Okrent and others in 1981. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, the history of even Rotisserie versions of fantasy sports date back further than that. It actually can be traced back to a professor who taught first at Harvard University and later at University of Michigan, where he met Dan Okrent, And you can trace this back even to the late 60s. Some people that play fantasy football trace it back to a different group, a group which has more of a gaming or gambling roots and less of an analytical roots back to that same period. But I don't think anyone thought that it would become what it was. In fact, while I was playing fantasy dating back into the late 1980s, I don't think anyone was able to envision the scope of this until the Internet hit.
With all the different variations, I mean, there are different. Obviously, there are thousands of websites and hundreds of variations. How do you pick a league to join?
I guess one thing is personal preference about the amount of time that you want to devote to it and the amount of skill that's involved. Legally speaking, just for a moment, a fantasy game is legal under state law as long as it involves what is deemed to be a sufficient amount of skill, which in most states means more skill than chance, and in a limited number of states means entirely skill. And in those states, fantasy sports will always be illegal. But leaving aside that, the question is, do you want to compete in a game which is highly mathematical and analytical, or do you want one which is more superficial, that you might be able to pick players directly off a tablet or without doing much research and number crunching?
What about the what are the main differences between I guess the ones that you have to pay an entry fee in are those that require a lot more skill as far as sitting down and analyzing. I mean, Lord knows when I go to the chain bookstores these days, there are more magazines about fantasy baseball than actual baseball.
One thing that I actually think is a dying industry is the fantasy baseball magazine industry. That is an industry that actually dates back to the early days of fantasy, the mid-1980s. And I'm very surprised to still see any of these magazines on the shelf. One of the problems with the magazine industry is, quite frankly, based on the days that they need to be printed, fantasy baseball magazines generally go to print in November or December. The reality is this is not good information to be using to assess your team because most drafts are held in early March, some late February, some late March, some early April. By that point in time, any of the players are reallocated onto different teams for free agents.
That's one of the things that I hadn't considered. I started reading this book, Winning Fantasy Baseball, Secret Strategies of a Nine-Time National Champion by Larry Schechter. I found him on Facebook, and we got into a little conversation. Obviously, I'm you know, a babe in the woods when it comes to this kind of stuff. And I didn't even consider that. Yeah, sure, if somebody goes to a different team in spring training, it might affect, if it's an offensive player, it might affect where he plays and how many at-bats he gets and how he's used. And so you're absolutely dead on when you say, you know, magazines that come out that have already been on in the shelves for a month are fairly useless.
Along those same lines, the way that fantasy is played, and frankly, I believe, is won, would be very different today than in the early days. And I think a lot of that is credit to the Internet as well. I think back to my first season when I played in a fantasy league. It was a New York-based league. The year was 1989, and my father and I co-owned a team that was run through J&J Fantasy Sports, which was a company based out of East Northport. And the first week of the season, I made what turned out to be an incredible waiver pickup. We picked up off the free agent wire an outfielder from the Chicago Cubs, who at the time was a rookie, Jerome Walton, who went on to win Rookie of the Year that season. Now, the reason we knew to pick up Jerome Walton and nobody else did was my father happened to have been on a business trip in Chicago that weekend, and he came back and said, "You might want to look at this Walton guy. This is all they're talking about on the news." Nowadays, it's not going to work that way, where you're going to be able to pick up a player because you're watching the news and everyone's not. There is an essence, and the way it's defined in the stock market, I think is true for sports now, there really is very close to perfect information. There's not going to be a name that someone else doesn't know or doesn't hear about. If anything, I think it's become reversed. One of the things I look at is if Matthew Berry, who writes for ESPN, touts the player. In my view, he's going to be overrated because of the inflationary impact that people place on people that get national attention that write on these sports, as opposed to the idea, oh, wow, let me see what this guy is writing because I'm probably going to find a sleeper that way.
Now, let's talk about what you do for a minute. One of the things on your CV is you are an and if I forgive me if I get this wrong, but you are an arbiter for league decisions.
Well, my full-time position is I'm an associate professor of law at Baruch College Zicklin School of Business. In addition to that, I have a legal consulting business and law business, which focuses on representing a wide range of companies, including startups in the fantasy sports industry, where I provide them with legal assistance. But way back when I was in law school, right around the year 2000, I had begun just for fun helping people resolve disputes in fantasy sports. And many moons ago, I put on the web a website known as sportsjudge.com, which uses real legal principles and real principles of arbitration to resolve disputes in fantasy contests. And we remain a viable site to this day with numerous practicing attorneys, judges, and law professors who occasionally will step in onto the court and resolve disputes that are submitted to us at sportsjudge.com.
Is that a large, I mean, are there a lot of people who avail themselves of this kind of service?
You know, it's limited because of the fact that it's a labor-intensive industry. And this is really something that we have run as a hobby because we're passionate about fantasy sports. Again, my full-time line of work is as a law professor. And second, I do consulting in a wide range of industries, including for a lot of the fantasy sports startups. And the reality is the rate which I will charge to be doing legal work would be a traditional lawyer's rate. For dispute resolution, we charge $15. It's really meant to be an issue of fun. It's a site that we could have grown substantially, but the trade-off is, do we want to become an arbitration service for extraordinarily elite leagues and charge what would be real legal services rate and maybe do one or two disputes a year? Or do we want to make this a fun thing that avails itself to people? And this is something that all of us do maybe about 1 or 2 hours per week, and we'll take on some disputes. And there certainly is room for growth in that market. It's just not one that makes sense to attempt to grow at this point.
Do you still play fantasy sports at this point?
Absolutely, I do. I play in a number of leagues. My friends from Wharton and I have a league together. My friends from Penn and I have a league. My friends from Michigan Law and I have a league, from Skadden Arps, and pretty much anywhere else where I've spent a substantial period of time. I really use it as a way of keeping in touch. It's also important for me to be versed about all the leagues that are going out there, how they operate both structurally and legally, because quite frankly, I have a client base now which involves a substantial number of the fantasy sports businesses, and part of me doing my homework and being able to stay on top of the business for them, and for some of the writing I do for Forbes, is to really know what's in there on a first-hand basis and not be finding out secondhand.
Now you say you're in a number of leagues. So, explain how that works. Do you have the same players on each team in all of your leagues, or how do you mix that up? How does that work?
Well, in every league, you're going to have an initial allocation of players, and in most leagues, they're allocated in one of two ways: an auction, in which you get a fictional amount of money, and you allocate money towards players, and the highest bidder gets each player. Mm-hmm. Or alternatively, the league draft, which is just a rotational snake where you go around choosing players. The reality of this is because in the few leagues I compete in, I'm competing against different players. It's impossible, even if I wanted to, ensure that I got entirely the same guys from time to time. If I don't have an early draft pick in a draft league, it's possible a player I want is gone. Or in an auction league, I might want a player. One of the more sophisticated strategies in auction is no one should just want a player to get them. Mathematically, they should be allocating the value of that player based on the pro rata stats they would be bringing in vis-a-vis the next best alternative. So I might really want Miguel Cabrera and raise him at a certain amount and raise him above the expected return that others might expect on him. But if I end up in a league where somebody thinks Miguel Cabrera is going to go break Barry Bonds' home run record next year and allocate that into their formula, that would not be a player that I would be able to get.
This is all fascinating stuff. Let me get you out of here on this. Is there any are there any books or articles you consider required reading for someone who really wants to, for a newbie to get involved in this?
I mean, there's different things that you look at. In my own bias, my favorite author is myself. There's no other reason. If you don't promote what you do, who else will? I actually did complete a piece for the Harvard Law Review a few years ago called A Short Treatise on Fantasy Sports and the Law. Because it was done for a law review, it's freely downloadable online. It's about a 60-page piece. It goes a lot into the law, but if you just want to know the history of fantasy, it's a painstaking attempt to take fantasy from the original idea generation to where it stands today, and there's about 20 pages on that. I think people will find this fascinating because I looked at fantasy, especially from the intellectual growth and development of the Rotisserie League, which includes Dan Okrent and some of the people you mentioned. And what I think will shock some of the people that read this is the real origins of the rotisserie format baseball and the version of fantasy that became most popular initially in the United States truly has an academic and intellectual culture. It was derived primarily by professors, historians, and journalists. It was very mathematical-oriented, almost a little bit sarcastic toward the issues that were going on in baseball at the time, and really can be looked at as a statement of the day and as a real number-crunching activity as opposed to what some of fantasy has become today. And when you look at it through that lens, if you play in one of the more complex analytical, mathematical, meet-in-person-for-a-live-draft-type league, you'll realize that you're not just playing a contest to play a contest, but you're now becoming a part of a vibrant and some would even say important academic and intellectual culture, which has been part, which has really been an institution in the United States now for over 30 years.
And finally, what about a primer on actually how to play? Any suggestions on that?
You know, the rules are going to be a little bit different from site to site, contest to contest. Any good league is going to have a league constitution. But general ideas about how to play fantasy sports, you know, Ron Chandler has written some good stuff from time to time. I would definitely look at Ron Chandler's blog. I find that to be helpful to talk about fantasy. There are sites out there, if you're looking to get your entire family involved, including children, there are family fantasy sports sites, which offer contests, which will not be for prizes of money, but will be used in an educational kind of way. I think that would be very helpful to look at as well. And to look at the league rules in whichever contest you're going into, because, you know, every competition is a little bit different in its form, and to really read the rules and understand the rules before you join, I think, is imperative to having a reasonable chance to win, and probably will increase the level of fun that you have along the way, too.
Sounds good. Well, Mark Edelman, thank you very much for being with us today, and stay warm.
As always, it's my pleasure, Ron.
And that does it for another podcast edition of the Baseball Bookshelf. I want to thank Mark Edelman. You can find out more about Mark at his website, markedelman.com. That's spelled markedelman.com. And also sportsjudge.com. Tune in again next week when our guest will be Kasia Kennedy, author of the new biography, Pete Rose, An American Dilemma. And I don't want to let this opportunity go by without thanking my birds for being so relatively quiet this week. Well, have a good week, everyone. Hope you're enjoying spring training and looking forward to the start of the new season in just a couple of weeks. Take care. Talk to you soon.
Pitching that fader so grand, he'd have said, boys, I'm glad I discovered this land.